Just ask Satchmo about Bix. He'll say, tell the whole world there'll never be another Bix Beiderbecke. He was a born genius, but they crowded him too much with love.
Every note he blew, it was so beautiful. And I liked it, singing the blues and records and things like that. There's nobody else going to blow that like he did. I never did play that tune on the kind of Bix because I didn't want to hear nobody mess with it, you know?
Be another Bix Beiderbecke. He was a born genius, but they crowded him too much with love. Bix was idolized by his contemporaries and understood by only a few. Bix was the ideal subject for the mythmakers, a ready-made hero when the jazz men of the 30s needed one. Beiderbecke's brief professional career spanned prohibition and speakeasies, high living, bathtub gin, and the birth of the big band. Bix was part of it all. He grew with jazz from the Mississippi River boats docked at his hometown to the roaring clubs of Chicago to the swank ballrooms of New York. For almost a decade, he not only played the piano and became author of several compositions, but he blew a horn like it had never been heard before or since. Bix was born into a middle-class family in Davenport, Iowa. A high school dropout, a self-taught musician. He led a colorful life, and he suffered an early death. Around this scanty framework, one of the most intricate legends anywhere in the jazz world was built. To try to untangle the facts from the fantasies, to cast a new light on one of America's most brilliant jazz musicians, to bring out the influence of Bix Beiderbecke upon a developing musical form, and to provide an entertaining insight into the early jazz age, This is Bix.
Yeah, sure. In a mist. It's a great, great thing. That was always the peaks of a party we'd have, you know. Bix would sit down and play, and of course, absolute quiet and much respect for what he could do. He was much ahead of his time. The cornet was his instrument. The piano was just a marvelous form of relief for him. The greatest genius that I have ever known in the world of jazz is Bix Beiderbecke. And you can quote Gene Krupa.
Bix Beiderbecke is the biggest thrill I ever had in the music business. I was an impressionable guy. It was still if I were here to hear Bix today for the first time, I'd still have the same impression. Guys like Beiderbecke, they don't have those by dozens. Just one. In case there's any doubt, my name is Conant, Eddie Conant, and I want to state right now, and I've stated many, many times, Beiderbecke is the biggest thrill I've ever had in the music business. He played the piano like no one else played the piano. He played the cornet like no one else played the cornet. Now, what more can I say? What a modest guy. And what a talented guy.
The most interesting thing I ever heard about Stardust, my writing Stardust, and it had become a hit. I'd never heard a word from Bix about the song. To finally, one day, very politely, he said, Hoagie, let the tune your Stardust. That's a pretty good tune.
Davenport, Iowa, lies on the western bank of the Mississippi River. It was in this growing city that Leon Bix Beiderbecke was born on March 10, 1903. His father, Bismarck Herman, was a merchant and later a part owner of the East Davenport Fuel Company. Mrs. Beiderbecke was known locally for her talents as a pianist. Bix was their third child. It had become a tradition with the Beiderbecke family to nickname the first son Bix, a tag derived from the more Germanic Bismarck. Bix's nephew, Richard Beiderbecke, explains this tradition.
Bix's father was Bismarck Herman, and this is where the Bix originated as the nickname for Bismarck. So then my father was born. It was Charles Burnett, but since he was the first son, he became Little Bix. And then when Bix was born, he was named Leon Bix. Now, we frequently see his name in print as Leon Bismarck, which was not correct, and which I suspect was picked up from his father's name.
As a very young boy, Bix Beiderbecke had an interest in music, in particular the piano. He apparently possessed a remarkable sense of tonal recognition or memory, as well as a creative drive. Bix's brother Charles recalls Bix picking out simple melodies on the piano.
I remember distinctly when he was very young, he'd go around to various neighbors, come home with nickels, dimes, and cookies. We'd ask him, how come? Well, I played a few ditties for him on the piano. He was very young at that time, just able to reach the keyboard. I would say he was about 6 years old, yeah. He just had it from the very beginning. I can't understand it. I don't know where it came from. They all appreciated him. He was a good kid as a little fella. He always was playing the piano.
Throughout his early life, Bix was exposed to the morals, culture, and training of a comfortable middle-class family. He may have had a brief encounter with formal piano lessons.
I do know of a piano teacher he studied with. He's supposed to have studied with him, and I can't imagine it because this piano teacher was strictly a classical piano teacher. He studied in Vienna. In fact, my brother took lessons from Charles Grotti. And Bix is supposed to have taken a few lessons from him, but he didn't keep him on because, of course, Bix didn't read well, and Bix would learn all this stuff from hearing him play it, and then he'd play it back to him again. But the association didn't last very long, according to what I've heard.
Those recollections by Bix's high school friend, Wayne Rolfe, concerning the piano are exact in respect to Bix's innate sense of pitch. This sense of pitch was to prove invaluable to Bix when, for the first time, he was exposed to jazz music. Bix's older brother, Charles, returned from the service in World War I with a phonograph. Bix was almost 16 years old when he heard the original Dixieland Jazz Band's recording of Tiger Rag.
In World War I and got out in 1918, and I bought this Victrola, and he'd go down and buy these Dixieland Jazz Band records. Bix would sit in front of this phonograph with a cornet that he borrowed from my Uncle Al, but the one he used most he borrowed from a neighbor boy by the name of Ficky. I don't know what happened to that cornet since. It was just amazing how well he did at that age.
Bix sought out jazz stylists wherever he could in those early Davenport days. This was the era of the Mississippi River excursion boat. Wayne Rolfe remembers Bix and those boats.
Around here, he'd go on the river boats and hear the different bands on the river boats. And at that time, most of the bands were coming out of St. Louis and New Orleans. Peyton Marable, I think Louis Armstrong worked with him at one time. Yes, I think Bix went on the boat to hear Armstrong because he came up the river here with Peyton Marable on the excursion boats. Which one, I don't know, because those fellas played one season on one boat and another season on another boat. But it's one of the earlier boats, like the Majestic or the St. Paul or one of those boats.
We were on the steamer St. Paul. And the Stretford line, they had four steamboats, you know. And I came up from New Orleans, which I played with Faith Babel on the steamer Sydney in New Orleans. So we come up to St. Louis and they get the big boat. And that's when we went up the river and got this big boat out of the chute. And who was standing there? This young kid, Big Spider-Man.
Bix carried his love of music with him through the Davenport High School days. He and his cornet were inseparable. Almost.
Bix was, above all, always a gentleman, and always had a good word for everybody. However, like most geniuses, he was somewhat forgetful and very easygoing. To illustrate this, I would like to tell you a few true stories about Bix. When Bix was in high school, the high school kids had a habit of walking down the Main Street Hill after school, and they'd congregate at Mayor's Ice Cream Parlor and Confectionery, just like the modern kids stop in someplace after school for a Coke. Bix carried his cornet in a paper bag because with an $8 horn, you didn't get a case. Occasionally, Bix would meet some of his friends and stand on the sidewalk in front of Mayor's and get into a long-winded conversation. And he'd get tired of holding his cornet, so he'd set it down on the sidewalk. After the conversation, he'd leave for home and forget all about his cornet. His friends, having seen this happen a few times, would take the cornet into Mayor's and leave it there, and in the evening when Bix missed it and wanted to go out and play on it, he'd hightail it down to Mayor's and get his cornet.
Bix's musical education continued through those Davenport days. another friend of that era, Eston Spurrier, helps set the perspective for the scope of Bix's involvement in music in his teens.
It's actually true that Bix picked up the cornet, and while a lot of your relatives and people around now claim him as a pupil and they saw his talent, he was run off by his uncle, who tried to teach him because he was a chasser, the old German hatred around our town for the jazzer.
Oh, yeah.
Was transmitted by a chasser, and Bix was a chasser, and so that he picked up the horn just for the interest of it, and all of the records at that time that you heard, plus the Columbia Circuit had a fine house in our town. It was a tryout house, so you got almost everything that went out on Columbia Circuit or that was tried. In the era when we were playing, we used to go to the Coliseum once in a while. It was a band. There were very few traveling bands, but B. Palmer, for instance, came through with a band that had Rapolo and Emmett Hardy. So they got stranded in Davenport, this B. Palmer act. And they worked with Carlisle Evans down at the Coliseum, and they were very forward, very advanced to anything that we had around that locality.
Bix's healthy, youthful spirit of rebellion was captured by the radical and generally scorned form of jazz. His protest, though mostly unconscious, was to take the new jazz to his heart. While a student at Davenport High School, Bix Beiderbecke made his first public appearance with his cornet. He was part of a vocal quartet in a vaudeville routine. As a finale to their performance, the one Negro member of the group did a lively tap dance to the music of Bix's artless improvisations. The other half of the group formed a crude rhythm section by clapping their hands. Bix bought a cornet from Dick Pootsier in 1919 and returned the borrowed instrument for good. The 16-year-old Beiderbecke spent all his time devouring music from every available source. He adapted the music he heard, and from the beginning, his jazz was a hybrid version of what he found. Dick Pootsier, in selling Bix a cornet, played a large part in establishing the legend during the first days of Bix's last year at Davenport High.
Went back to high school, and then I think we had an auditorium meeting the very first day. And Bix and I were sitting together in the back of the auditorium. So we were talking out of the corners of our mouth while the principal was giving his speech there, and Bix wanted to know about the job we'd been on. And I said, "Well, Bix, I've blown out my my lip. I think I'm going to sell my cornet." And he said, "Well, how much do you want for it?" And I said, "Oh, about $35. He said, "Come on." And grabbed me. And we got out of the auditorium, went across the hall into the music room, and we consummated a deal on the cornet. $35. Bix said, "I haven't got $35. I'll give you $15 right now." And he said, "I'll give you the rest over a period of the months out of my allowance." So that was when Bix bought that cornet that has become so famous in all the pictures. About 2 months later, we were playing a little fraternity dance at the Bettendorf Town Hall. Bettendorf is a little town just north of Davenport. It connects now and so on. And the fraternities and sororities always had little parties along the line, and so we were playing that, and I can't recall who that was, maybe some pickup group from high school. I'm standing on the corner waiting for the streetcar to go to Bettendorf, and I notice Bix across the street, and he spots me, and he comes hightailing it over, and he said, "Where are you playing tonight?" I said, "Bix, we're going to play out at the Bettendorf Town Hall." He said, "Do you mind if I come out and set in?" And I said, "No, come on out, Bix. I get along with the cornet." He said, "Well, I'll go home and get the cornet." He couldn't wait. Bix had to get on two streetcars to get home. He had to come back on and get take three straight streetcars to get to Bettendorf. He got there about 10 o'clock or 10:30, and I'm sure that he was going as hard as he could go. I can see the guy walk through the corner door to the dance hall here. All of the floor was full of kids. Instead of walking around the side, as you might normally do, he just had to get there as fast as he could. He came right through that dance floor, opened up the case in the middle of a tune, and put that horn up to his lips and started in. And we just, it almost floored us. Now, it wasn't perfect by any matter of means, and he hit a lot of clams. But there were just enough of those beautiful little variations, figurations, and fill-ins that, you know, you couldn't believe it. And here he was on his way. And the only one job that I can recall where Bix really was in full time was out of Durant, which is about 20 miles from Davenport. And Bix was sitting right alongside of me, having quite a time for himself, hitting, it wasn't good, but to me it was great. I mean, he hit a lot of bloopers, and he was fumbling, but he was just good enough so that I was just thoroughly enjoying it. Intermission came. I'm down on the dance floor, and the fellow that had that old hall was a fellow by the name of Louis Sewell. And old Louis came over to me, and he poked his finger in my chest, and he said, "Say," he says, "what is that?" "Yes." He says, "that cornet player of yours, he squeaks on that thing." Well, actually, Bix wasn't hitting the high ones. You know, he never could, really. He was just, but he was doing things that they were just not familiar with, and they couldn't understand it. But, of course, we fellows in the band were getting quite a kick out of it, and Bix was coming. He was coming along fine. So we played quite a few jobs where we used Bix, and then about that time they were completing a new building in Davenport called the Call Building. And in the Call Building they had the Capitol Theater, which had a pit orchestra, and down in the basement they were trying to do a sort of a miniature terrace gardens idea. The place was terraced up with tables, and the orchestra was down in here in the corner. So Buckley got the job to play that in there, in the terrace gardens. We became quite a popular band around there, and we were non-union. And of course the union were not too pleased about this. You can understand that. So we did have the job sewed up. We were about ready to go in there and open the place up. And the pit orchestra heard that there was a scab band going to be playing in the terrace gardens in the same building, and they said, "Ah, we won't do it." So then, of course, it was necessary to try to get in the union. Well, the Buckley Novelty Orchestra was made up of banjo, saxophone, violin, drum, and piano. With the addition of Bix, we had a drive, we had a force in there, and we had some hot stuff that kind of gave us a little different sound. So we actually were getting the job based on our having Bix with us. Well, this posed a problem, because while I could read to some extent, Bix at that time couldn't read a thing, not a thing. So we wanted the job very badly, and we rehearsed with music stands in front of us and music in front of us, and we looked at the music, and we tried to look real legit. We never used a sheet, of course, of music when we were playing with Buckley. It was all impromptu set. So we came up to the day of the union examination. And we had agreed to meet at Hickey's Cigar Store on the corner of 3rd and Harrison Street, right near the union headquarters. Bix was as nervous as a cat. The YMCA was just up the street one block. We were all early. We were eager. We were so conscientious and everything. We were there a half an hour early, I guess. We were sort of chewing our fingernails, and Bix says, "Look, I think we just got time.
to go to the YMCA and have one more go at it. We said, all right, here we go. So we went up to the Y, put up our, went through the whole routine, the music racks, the music, the whole smear, and went to it. And then it was time to go to the union headquarters. Well, everything went fine for about two or three numbers. And a fellow by the name of Roy Kautz, who was the musical director of the Orpheum Theater, was doing the examination. So then Roy, I don't know whether he did this on purpose, whether he was a little tired of Buckley's novelty orchestra getting a lot of the cream of the jobs around there. But he decided to take each man individually. Well, I managed to get through all right, and I think the rest of the fellows did. But when he got to Bix, he put a regular arrangement in front of the... I remember the thing was a long sheet like so. And there was a cornet solo, and the piano was just playing da-da-da-da-da, or, you know, a little accompaniment there. So what happens, Bix looks at the sheet up there, and instead of playing the solo up here, he's playing da-da-da-da-da, just like that after each note that the piano player played. And it's really still clear, and I'm surprised that it is. In my mind, I can see Roy Kautz saying, "Here, young man," he said, "you play your part, not the piano part." Well, this was it. You see, he couldn't do it. So he put his arm around Bix and he said, "Look, young man," he said, "I think you better go home and practice for about six months and then try it again." Well, Bix burst into tears. He really did. He just bawled because he knew that he'd lost up the job for us, and the job over at the Terrace Gardens was pretty well predicated on him being with the band.
During these days, Bix was a congenial member of his family, barring an incident recalled by his brother Charles.
He busted up my Studebaker Roadster one night. We had to get a coal truck and go about 20 miles out of Davenport to have it pulled in. I don't remember the particulars, but I was a little angry with him. We didn't get along too good for a few weeks after that. That was before he got out of high school. He was very well liked all through his high school days. He played a good game of baseball, and he was very fond of tennis. And I'll be glad to show you a cup that he won in a tennis tournament when he was quite young.
Naturally, the compelling force that drove Bix to search out every source of education and experience with the cornet did not drive him toward conventional education. He managed to scrape through final exams at Davenport High, but his schoolwork suffered as his musical ability grew.
In fact, he'd sit in with various bands around the Tri-Cities to such an extent that his grades were terrible, and the folks, I don't know whether it's a mistake or whether it was to his advantage, sent him to Lake Forest Academy, right outside of Chicago. Well, I think that was the worst thing he could do as far as study was concerned, because he'd go down and play with the various bands in Chicago.
Lake Forest was perhaps a wise choice in an academic sense, but it was located only 28 miles from Chicago. And the South Side of Chicago was rapidly gaining a reputation as the new hotbed of jazz. Bix Beiderbecke was in town and on his way. This is Bix, a biographical series made possible through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Consultants for the series were John Steiner, along with Joseph Campbell and Philip Evans. Commentary was recorded by Frank Powers. Continuity was written by Mary Kay Fulton. Audio engineer, Michael J. McGuire. Bix was researched, produced, and directed by Jim Grover. This is Bill Utter speaking for Miami University Radio.
Limited rights for this rebroadcast of Bix on WMKV 89.3 FM Cincinnati were given by WMUB-FM, Miami University Broadcasting in Oxford, Ohio, courtesy of WMUB-FM General Manager Cleve Callison. WMUB-FM originally produced the program for broadcast in 1971. Any rebroadcast, internet streaming, or archiving of this program by anyone other than WMKV is prohibited. WMKV would like to thank the original producer of the program, Jim Grover, for his vision and efforts to preserve this unique chapter in the history of jazz, authored by Bix, and Mr. Bill Utter, Director Emeritus of Miami University Broadcasting, who conceived the original program idea, narrated the original series, and has been instrumental in making this rebroadcast possible. Dave Bartholomew, volunteer and host of the WMKV weekly program Friction, deserves special thanks for his labor of love in remastering Bix. The advisory group that oversaw the project to rebroadcast Bix include Frank Powers, commentator on the original series, Dave Bartholomew, Bill Utter, Cleve Collison, WMUB general manager, Dave Schramm, WMKV coordinator of online services, Mike Farrar, WMKV coordinator of production services, Joe Schooner, WMKV intern from the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, Media Division, and Alan Bayoski, WMKV general manager. Please stay tuned for the best in big band era music right here on WMKV, the way radio was meant to be.